In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
In our country, you know, we have kind of, I'd say, jumped the shark in terms of what is acceptable to consumers in our agriculture system. The consumers just don't know it. Because there's natural how I mean it, and then there's natural how, again, the USDA allows people to define it. So in our country, the term natural means almost nothing. People who have been raising pigs in Iowa for three generations, they don't believe inherently what they're doing is wrong. And so convincing them to change over, you're not convincing them to change philosophically. All you can do is convince them that they can make more money if they change their system. We've been curing meat for thousands of years. So before the advent of a lot of technology that we have, it can be done safely at small scale for sure.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. We provide you with everything you need to know for total performance, fat loss, recovery, digestion, sleep, brain, and hormone optimization. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you just want to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield, and if you're like me, you've occasionally wandered into the meat section of the grocery store or a butcher shop or one of these fancy charcuterie-style restaurants, and you've been kind of perplexed about like which cuts to get and how to know if the meat is actually safe and actually healthy, the difference between words like natural and grass-fed and grain-fed and hormone-free and CAFO-free and humanely raised and all these terms that tend to be associated with meat these days. It seems almost more complex than it should be. Well, today we're going to delve into the mystery of meat with Jacob Dixon. And Jacob is with Dixon's Farm Stand Meats. And he describes it as a candy shop for carnivores and one of the most sought-after purveyors of fine quality meats in the city of New York. And they offer things like artisanal meats and house-made charcuterie made from animals raised without added hormones or prophylactic antibiotics or animal byproducts, whatever those are. So we're going to delve into all that with Jacob today. So Jacob, thanks for coming on the call, man.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
So, you know, from what I understand, you came into the food industry originally from the world of corporate marketing. How'd that happen?
Well, you know, for me, I used to work for American Express for many years. And I was looking for a business I wanted to start. And I wanted to start something in an area that I was passionate about. I was looking to start a business in something that I would start and sell it, not an entrepreneur from that perspective. I was looking for an industry that I would start and be in for the next 35 years. I was enjoying my time in American Express. I got to use my brain every day, but it wasn't satisfying. I was looking for something bigger. At the same time, in parallel, I was I call myself a foodie. I was passionate about cooking, and I was a big carnivore. And one day I kind of realized, here I eat meat every single day almost, but I know nothing about how it gets from a farm and what a farm might even look like to my plate. And so I went about educating myself and, you know, and I started researching and reading books and going online. And the more I learned, the more kind of horrified I was about the industrial agricultural processes in our country.
Like what kind of stuff? Were you like going to specific websites, like watchdog websites, or were you reading books that made you nervous about this stuff? Or like what was it that you found that you were using as a resource?
A little bit of everything, truthfully. I mean, it started with kind of reading, I think a great primer for everyone is Michael Pollan's Omnivore Dilemma. It's not my favorite now that I'm more into the industry for a lot of reasons, but I think it's a great starting place. It kind of is like a eye-opening book for you. Kind of makes you start asking a lot of questions. And then from there, I just started basically becoming a massive consumer of information online, what was out there. And then books I was buying, all the Joel Solomon books, sort of a big jumping off point from Omnivore to Loveland, getting into his perspective of things. But really, the more I was learning, it started then driving me to look for better solutions. You know, where could I buy meat that I was happy with it? And the truth is, I was struggling to find them. There weren't great options. Either I could buy at the farmer's market, but everything was frozen and pre-cut, or you could go to the supermarket, and I wasn't happy about things that were the way things were raised. I couldn't find someone doing kind of the whole package. And kind of said to myself, you know, maybe this is it. Maybe if you could figure out how to do this well, there was a business there. Because there are either people out there like me looking for better options, or if you could open people's eyes and educate them, there would be a near infinite amount of people that would be interested in what we could offer. So I started reading more and working on a business plan. But the thing about meat is that it's very hard to do right. There are so many moving parts, so many things to learn. I said, you know, I got to just throw away the business plan for right now and quit my job and just dive into the field. And I spent a year just kind of traveling the country, working on farms, working in a butcher shop in Minneapolis, working at the slaughterhouse that we now use, just because I felt that to do meat, it's a hands-on industry. I needed to have hands-on experience with it. And so I just said, I'm not even going to think about what this business is going to look like. All I know is it's going to be in meat. It's going to be working with small farmers. And I'm going to learn and then let the business kind of ferment as I go through it. And then at the end, I kind of crossed my fingers and said, there's going to be a business plan. That's going to be the way forward after this year.
Yeah. I mean, I could imagine it'd be a pretty steep learning curve, even for just myself. You know, learning how to field dress and skin and quarter a deer has been, you know, just an enormous process in and of itself. My wife recently butchered a whole hog. And for her, you know, that was having to be immersed in learning about it for literally weeks. So I can't imagine what would go in learning what you would need to know to do what you're doing now, because you're like the main butcher at this Dixon's Farm Stand now, right?
I actually don't consider myself a butcher. I believe that my role in Dixon's Farm Stand is kind of a curator of both products and people. So, for instance, it would take me a decade to be as talented as a chef as my chef, and it would take me, you know, 6 years to learn the skill set that a butcher has. So can I bring everybody together. So yes, I can cut meat. And yes, I know a lot about agriculture. And yes, I know a lot about sausage making. But I hire individual specialists that bring them into my organization. And then we work together to create what is now Dixon's Farm Stand.
So I've got kind of a weird question for you. But if you could choose like one animal, and I'm going to totally gross out all of our plant-based listeners, but if you could choose one animal that you were going to butcher, in terms of just like either the ease or the enjoyment or, you know, whatever it is that turns you on when you're butchering an animal, what animal would it be?
For me personally, because it's kind of probably in the business aspect of it, it's the pig. Pigs are great for so many reasons. From a farmer's perspective, it allows a small farmer with minimal investment and infrastructure and time to really get a farm going in a short period of time, because pigs grow quickly. From a butcher's perspective, the yield on them is tremendous. You know, almost the entire pig. When we butcher a pig, we can get as high as 86% of the carcass as a retail saleable product. That's tremendous. There's so little waste there compared to beef and lamb. And then from a chef's perspective, pork is just so versatile and you can do with it. You know, making sausage, charcuterie, it is the most versatile and profitable species because of all these things, kind of throughout the whole supply chain. So that's why I like pigs, and they're great and they're delicious, obviously, if they're good. Also for pork's perspective, the pork that I offer is such a huge gulf in difference in quality for what you find from commercial hogs in the U.S. I mean, it might not be well raised, you know, and I might have problems with the supply chain and the ethics behind it, but you can go into a high-end supermarket and buy, I'm going to say in quotes that you can't see, high-quality beef, right? You can buy prime steer, it dry age, it's going to taste good. But you can't really go into a supermarket and buy delicious pork. It just doesn't really exist anymore in the U.S.
Yeah.
So, and there's such a gulf between that product that I offer that we call pork and the product that's in the supermarket called pork.
Yeah.
In terms of home butchering, I think the best pieces by far for people just getting started is lamb, actually, because they're super simple to break down. You can basically do it. You know, you could watch a couple videos online, and with a cleaver and a butcher's knife and a boning knife, you could break down a lamb pretty easily. Like I could teach you in one session enough that you could break a lamb home and not do a beautiful job with it, but you could break it down. Mm-hmm. And so I think lambs are a great starting place for people, and then pigs. Now, if you ask my butchers what their favorite species is, they'd all say beef, because beef is challenging and complicated and big, and everything about it's big. It's expensive to buy. There's a lot of waste that you can't afford to waste a single piece of things. If there's a lot of fat and trim that goes in the garbage. So beef, if you're a butcher, is probably your favorite. But I think pigs are great for everything else, and lambs are great for home. It's a long answer to a simple question, I guess.
Yeah. When my wife went and butchered the whole hog, she actually just got one from a local farmer. And, you know, the bacon alone, you say that it's hard to get good quality pork. And I remember the first time that we had bacon just cooked over the cast iron skillet at our house. And it's a night and day difference between like the best, most expensive bacon we can find at the grocery store. She used this book called Beyond Bacon. Have you heard of this one?
Mm-hmm. I have not.
Yeah, really interesting recipe. It's actually a paleo book. It's called Paleo Recipes That Respect the Whole Hog. But really, really, really cool book, you know, in terms of teaching you some interesting pork recipes. And I'm totally in agreement with you that pork tastes completely different than anything we could find anywhere else. So I've got a few questions for you here about meat and knowing what to get when you walk into a butcher shop or into the meat section of your local supermarket. When you do that, how do you know that the meat that you're getting is actually healthy? Like, what kind of things should you look for on the label?
Well, I mean, I guess there's healthy in a lot of ways, right? There's healthy, you know, there's a couple questions that you're asking. Healthy could be, you know, fat content. I think I don't believe that that's the kind of healthiness that we should care so much about in our meat, especially where I suggest people eat in moderation. When I think about healthy, I want to put in my body things that are well raised from a humane treatment perspective. That matters a lot to me. But then also on how the animal is raised in terms of what went into its body, because I think that affects what goes into our body. You know, in our country, you know, we have kind of, I'd say, jumped the shark in terms of what is acceptable to consumers for agriculture. In our agriculture system, the consumers just don't know it, really. You know, we've done a really good job of slaughtering on a massive scale, raising animals on a massive scale, and nobody sees it. You know, if you think about it, you know, there's like 6 million steers a month, I believe, are slaughtered in our country. And has anybody, you know, ever seen it, right? The average person? Because it's kind of tucked away and we don't see it. See, there's this massive system in place to supply us, and it's developed to hide the bad practices that are out there. Those practices for me are basically widespread use of hormones, growth promoters, beta antagonists in beef, antibiotics in pork and chicken. You know, those are the things that I'm trying to avoid because I believe that they have both humane implications for the animals and also for ourselves from a healthfulness perspective.
Okay. I want to ask you some targeted questions about that stuff because, I mean, mm-hmm. we hear those terms thrown around like all the time, right? Like hormonally raised mm-hmm. and no added hormones and no antibiotics. But, you know, for example, humanely raised. Like, how do you know, how do you specifically know that the animal that you're getting there at the, well, I actually don't really know, even know how it works. You just get these big dead animal carcasses or are the animals coming live to you?
So because I want to opt out of the commercial meat industry, I have built my entire supply chain from scratch. So the slaughterhouse that we use is where I work. It's 3 hours north of here. I'm going to be there tomorrow, actually, with a group of students. We use that as kind of our point of consolidation. So each of my farmers, I work with just 4 farmers. I tried to, you know, we grew our businesses together. I want to work more deeply with fewer farmers. We can control more variables, know more about each other. those farmers bring the animals to the slaughterhouse. Lowell and his two sons run the place. They slaughter for us there. And we have our own trucks that we, in the farm, that we use to transport the animals in. It actually lives up there. My driver lives 5 miles from the slaughterhouse. So every Tuesday morning, he pulls up, and all the animals have been slaughtered for us for that week are loaded into the truck and brought down. The pigs and lambs come in whole, and the beef come in quartered. So we can control as much of the butchering and processing in our store, so we bring them in as large as pieces as possible. Nothing comes in a box. Nothing comes from an outside supplier. It only comes from my group of farms who are raising specifically for us and bringing to our one slaughterhouse. Basically, I want very deep relationships so I can understand as much as possible about these farms. I've been working with most of our farmers for about 7 years now, since the very beginning. And for me to bring in a new farmer, I've got to get really comfortable. And we start really slow, one animal here and there. And as we become closer with each other and our organization, their farm and our butcher shop, and the quality and consistency and how the animals are raised, we'll start building our business up together.
So when an animal is humanely raised, what exactly mm-hmm. does that mean? What's happening to the animal as it grows up that causes an animal to be humanely versus non-humanely? Because like I've been to some places where it seems like it's a commercial feedlot, and the mm-hmm. animals still seem to be kind of in the field. Like there's a lot of them out there, you know, kind of in close quarters. But you know, I'm curious where you draw the line between something being humane versus non-humane.
Well, I believe that humans as a species, that we have an internal mechanism about and a feeling and understanding about what is correct from in terms of scale. And I think a lot of agriculture and humane, not that you can't be small and inhumane, but a lot of agriculture and food production, it's about scale and small scale and controlling variables. That's where we're concentrating on. So I'm looking for small scale producers that are interested in staying, not they want to be viable farms, but staying on the small scale and raising animals well, where they have room to roam and express themselves. And then they don't, you know, when you start getting up to scale or mistreating, they'll more likely need antibiotics and other things to keep them healthy. So we're looking at kind of a small scale operation where animals can be themselves, you know, their pigginess, not that they're wild animals, but they have room to root and socialize, access to outdoors at all times. And these are the things that we're looking for. And I agree with you. Some of it is kind of hard to pin down. You know, how do you define it? Because one of the problems we've had in our country is when things are become defined terms by the USDA, once it's written on paper and says this is what it means, the industry then can follow the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law. A great example of that is the term free range for chicken. Mm-hmm. Right? Free range, when the term was developed, was really about that happy chicken running around the field that farmers were believing in, you know, that you picture. But when it was written down on paper by the USDA, companies could follow the letter of the law saying it has access to outdoors, but not necessarily that the chickens ever go outdoors. And didn't they describe what the outdoors looked like or how much access there was. So free range became a term that at one point meant something, but once it became a defined term by the USDA, it ceased to lose its meaning. You see that a little bit with grass-fed as well. You know, grass-fed, you can follow the letter of the law by, you know, feeding them, you know, forage, you know, no grain during their life cycle, but you could be a grass-fed feedlot as well. You know, and that's a term that, whereas when it came about, people were trying, it was really that pasture-raised ideal that you're picturing for beef. So one of the reasons during my journey why I spent time working on farms before I got started is that I needed to learn for myself, not for what I was reading in books, but have firsthand knowledge of what I consider to be acceptable agricultural practices for my business and for myself, what I would want to eat. And that's why I went and worked on farms. And the first farm I worked at actually was kind of right on the border. There are things that I thought were great about that farm. It was Cornell University Sheep Farm. But other things, I said, you know, I'm not really comfortable with the way they're doing things. Yes, these animals are pretty healthy, but they never go outside from when they're born to when they're slaughtered for the lamb. It was a little bit too commercial of an operation for me. You know, so I kind of want to go a little bit farther towards the small scale and independent farmer than what I was seeing there. But I'm glad that I worked on that farm because it kind of gave me that firsthand experience about that kind of middle road. It wasn't a massive feedlot, but it wasn't quite what I was going for my farmer.
Gotcha. So if I pick up a piece of meat at the store and it says grass-fed, is there a way for me to know if that's humanely raised grass-fed versus kind of like the half-assed version of grass-fed that you're talking about where it's still a feedlot, but they're technically getting grass?
You know, that's a big problem. And that's why my business is so extreme in one direction, is that there isn't a great way to know. You know, the best thing you can do is start asking lots of questions in the supermarket. And if there's no one to answer those questions, it means that it probably isn't, you know, as far down the path of humane and small scale and helpful as a shop that can answer those questions. It's really hard to get to scale in the kind of business that we run. You know, to run a wholesale brand, you're paying farmers a lot. It's very difficult. So if it's something and you need to get a high dollar value for it. So if it's at a low cost and it's sitting on, you know, a supermarket shelf with nobody to kind of explain what it is, chances are it's either the commodity or somewhere in between. You know, very people can get the premium you need for raising animals on a small scale and sell it wholesale. So that's why buying from small scale places like mine or other premium shops opening around the country, or buying directly from the farmer where they can capture more of the retail dollar, that's a much more likely place where you are going to find meat like ours, raised on small scale and well-raised meat.
So it's a better idea if you're actually going to buy meat to not go into a grocery store and buy it. I was actually recently at a conference and I was sitting with a guy named Daniel Vitalis, a friend of mine who also has a podcast. And the way he described it was he said that basically poor people have the mentality of buying food in these small quantities, like a pack of carrots or like a piece of steak from the grocery store, and that healthy people or people with an attitude of abundance, they'll purchase their meat as like the whole hog, or they'll go out of their way to go like to the butcher shop and buy like larger quantities of high quality meat, or they'll like, you know, grow their own carrots or go to the farmer's market and buy big bundles and, you know, learn how to store those properly. So when it comes to purchasing meat, would you say that people should just for the most part avoid the supermarket and the grocery store and just find like a specialty butcher shop to work with if they're not going to like buy the whole cow themselves?
Yes. I mean, that's obviously what I advocate, but I'm biased. I own a specialty butcher
shop. Well, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's your best option. I mean, I would, if you have access to directly to a farmer and want to buy in bulk, I think that's, you know, buy a half deer or split it with family. It's the most economical way. If you don't have access to a place like us and don't want to buy in large quantities, I think farmers markets are the next best thing. And those are the best solutions. And I think when we think about economics, you know, the ground beef from a well-raised animal is just as healthful as a ribeye from a well-raised animal. That's going to cost a lot less. So I think that you're always going to have to keep cost and quality in perspective, especially when we're talking about healthfulness and nutrition, because there's not more nutrition in a ribeye. It's just more tender. And, you know, so I always say, you know, ribeyes are not sustainable, right? Ground beef is sustainable. There's a lot of ground beef on the animal, and there's not a lot of tenderloin and ribeye on the animal. So if you want to support local farmers and local butcher shops and local agriculture and have well-raised meat at a reasonable price, it's about buying sausage and ground meat and those other cuts. It's not about buying middle meat, you know, those premium cuts that you're used to.
Gotcha. Okay, now how about the word natural? You see the word natural appear on a lot of this packaging. What exactly does that mean? I mean, is that just something that anybody can slap on, or how's the word natural?
Yeah. Using the term natural in our logo is actually one of my regrets. I got to go back and forth about. Because there's natural how I mean it, and then there's natural how, again, the USDA allows people to define it. So in our country, the term natural means almost nothing. There's two ways that can be used. There can be the term natural, which means minimally processed, basically that it has kind of no additives and it's not mechanically separated. which means basically spraying something down with a pressure washer and then collecting the bits and parts from the drain, for lack of a better description. So in that sense that, you know, almost any meat you buy, regardless of how it's raised, it can be labeled as natural for that perspective. The other way you see natural, you'll see natural asterisk at the supermarket. Now, what that allows is it's a marketing term that companies can go and register with the USDA and give their definition of natural. So it can say, for, you know, let's say CAB, the the Certified Angus Program, they can say, for us, natural means no hormones and no antibiotics, right? And they register that definition with the USDA, and they can put it on their marketing materials, and you'll always see the asterisk, and you can look on the back of the package, or often it's even more misleading. They'll say, see pamphlet or go online for our definition of natural. So it can mean something different everywhere you go. So we define natural, I mean, the way I personally define natural is the same kind of trying to gather up these feelings about when I visit my farm and our process and the things that we make. So it's about small scale family farms. It's about small slaughterhouses that take care with each animal. It's about handling every carcass in the optimal way and respecting the animal. And then our store, we make everything by hand in small scale, small batches. That's kind of what I meant by natural. Gotcha. So I think it is a very confusing term for the consumer.
Yeah. Okay. So natural pretty much means jack squat, really. I mean, if it's on the label.
Pretty much. Okay. But you see it on a package. So if you come into my store now, we've got natural in our logo, but none of our other materials ever use the term because we kind of realized as we got into it, it's kind of a loaded term in the U.S. And at some point, we'll probably revise our logo and eliminate that term because it means so little in the U.S. at this point.
And you actually have some blog posts on your website at the DixonsFarmStand.com site. And in one of the articles that you have over there, you talk about antibiotics and why they're actually used and how there's kind of some misconceptions out there about why antibiotics are used. Can you get into the idea behind those misconceptions? Like, why is it that animals are fed antibiotics?
So there's really two reasons why you would feed an animal antibiotics. And so the first is for growth promotion, and the second is for healthfulness, right, for the animal. Now, the way we started using, you know, why antibiotics are problematic in our country, forgetting about creating resistance for the human population, so you have animals, right? Animals can get sick, and you treat them with antibiotics. You always see in our marketing, we say no prophylactic antibiotics. So even in the best of circumstances, the well-raised animals get an eye infection. They have a foot problem. We always want our farmers to be able to treat that animal with antibiotics if it is injured. The problem is more with prophylactic antibiotics. So using it on an animal that is not yet sick, and as a preventative, to keep it from getting sick. That's where we're getting into a practice that allows agriculture to exist at densities and treatment levels that I don't believe we should be doing. So it allows you to put more chickens into one coop, more pigs into a warehouse at once. And by treating them with antibiotics, you keep them from getting sick. And the way the industry justifies it, saying that, oh, you know, if we didn't treat them, then they would get sick and there would be problems with humane. But I believe it's a system of density and scale that is inherently inhumane, and the antibiotics are just an enabler of that industry, and that scale.
So do you think it's ever okay to use antibiotics with me?
I do.
In which case?
In the first case. So the way we would allow our farmers, so if there is an injury or an animal gets sick, you treat the animal with antibiotics. You know, small-scale farmers can't afford to not use an animal that may have got an illness. And just like people, we get over illnesses. It's about minimal antibiotic use as much as possible, and for very short courses, and far before the animal is ever brought to slaughter.
Have you ever wondered if like in humans, how nowadays with alternative medicine, in a lot of cases when people get sick, we'll use things like probiotics and essential oils, mm-hmm. and vitamin C and zinc and things like that to assist the immune system with natural healing. Why is it that something like that couldn't be used with animals?
It is, actually, and all of our farmers practice that as much as possible. We really try to use as little antibiotics and call the vet as little as possible for an animal. You can do it through nutritional supplements. People use oregano and oregano oil. We use probiotics and preventative measures and natural deworming methods as much as possible on animals. But I don't want for our farmers, I never draw a line that says you can never use antibiotics on an animal that is injured or sick. But yes, I believe just like with people, we should do as much as possible to minimize the use of antibiotics for sure. And that's a big difference. I was watching a video of a farmer at a big pork place in Iowa, at a big pork warehouse and factory farm. And he's just walking around with it looks like a cough gun, basically, full of antibiotics. And any animal that looks a little pale or looks a little like has a light limb, he's just hitting it. Like, you know, in the 5 minutes in the video, he must have given antibiotic treatment to 20 or 30 different animals. And he's just hitting them and then spray painting them as if they've been marked. Hitting them and spray painting them so he doesn't double dose them. It's that total near indiscriminate use of antibiotics in that way. That's a problem. And this is also one farmer in the industrial system is caring for thousands of animals, right? You know, in one day they can feed like 15,000 pigs because so much is automated. On our farm, even our largest farm, that's raising 600 pigs a year, which is not a lot, they know every single pig, right? They're keeping an eye on that pig. They saw an eye infection. You know, if you think about it, I think of our farmers as like the headmaster of a small high school. A headmaster, they know every kid and what's going on. You know, they know the personality, they know the issues, and so they are looking out for those. These pigs are also, each individual animal at the scale we're talking is extremely valuable to a small farmer. And so they are looking out for the best interests of every single animal. They can afford to have high mortality rates. Whereas if you look at the industrial system, there is an expected loss on each animal, and each animal is kind of a widget. And the more widgets they raise, the more that they are growing. They're automating as much as possible, so each individual animal is not that valuable to the system. And that leads to all of these issues that we're talking about inhumane treatment, devaluing the life of the animal. And when you devalue the life of the animal, the healthfulness and the way you raise it doesn't become as important anymore. You know, terms like antibiotic use, humane, they become marketing terms. They actually don't really mean anything about the soul of the farmer and the animal itself. It's not about caring for the individual animal. It's being able to say, oh, well, if I can be never, ever antibiotic, I can sell more meat or at a higher premium. You know, those things are important to a farmer from an economic viability, but that's not why we should be raising animals and caring about what we consume. You know, that's about what can I put on my label so I can get 10 cents more a pound. It's not about what do I believe in and how I raise animals.
Yeah.
And that's a huge barrier to converting our system because people who have been raising pigs in Iowa for three generations, they don't believe inherently, for the most part, that what they're doing is wrong. And so convincing them to change over, you're not convincing them to change philosophically. All you can do is convince them that they can make more money if they change their system. And that's a challenge. I think that's a challenge for everyone because if you don't actually believe in it, are you really going to follow, are you just going to follow the letter of the law and not the spirit of the law of what you're practicing?
Yeah, it's a good point. It's kind of like this concept of when you raise your own animals, you know, when you have like Bessie the cow in your backyard that you're going to eat in 2 years, you're going to take a lot different care of that animal because it is this single individual animal that has a spirit or a soul and that you have a connection with and that you're going to treat far differently versus that faceless, nameless cow that's in a feedlot.
And that's one of the reasons why in our shop, you know, we put pig heads in our case every week when they arrive. Nobody ever buys a pig head. But it's about reminding people that that pork chop at the other end of the case came from a pig that had a head and lived on a farm not that far from there. We always have to try to remind people of the connection that meat is not just, you know, it's not the same as a protein shake. It came from an animal that was living. If someone took a long time, whether it be 9 months for a pig or almost 2.5 years first year, someone took a long time and a lot of care in raising that animal.
Yeah, it's a good point. Well, I want to shift focus here and ask you a little bit about like this whole curing and dry aging process. The first thing I want to ask you about is when it comes to dry aging, one of the things I've seen out there is that when you dry age, and I know this is something that like Dave Asprey of Bulletproof Exec will talk about, the mold and fungus will form on that meat when it's dry aging, and that's part of the curing process. And you know, he says that that could potentially be unhealthy or cause health issues. What's your take on mold and fungus? Why does it grow when you're dry aging, and what's the purpose of that? And then do you have any thoughts about the health or lack thereof when that happens?
Well, it's interesting, interesting question. So the first thing I would say about dry aging, that it is more art than science, and there are different ways to practice. And then when it comes to mold and fungus, there are millions of different strains, right? And whether it be dry aging or dry curing, and the strains that you are cultivating could be positive or negative. So answering the first question, so we do a lot of dry aging in our store, but the style of dry aging we do is about high airflow, very cold temperatures, and lower humidity. So we actually, in our dry aging process, cultivate almost no molds and fungus. We don't get that funky trade flavor, so we're actually cultivating more a dehydration, so evaporation of water from the meat to concentrate the flavor and alter the balance of water to fat to make it seem juicier, and an enzymatic process, which tenderizes the meat. So we actually, our dry aging process, as we practice it, has almost no mold growth, no fuzzy growth. I can send you pictures of it. We don't have that kind of funky looking exterior with fuzzy molds of any color.
Is that because of the actual temperature? You said it's colder than usual, or is that because
actually it's more a function of humidity and airflow.
What humidity do you guys cure at?
So our humidity is a little bit lower. People usually do from the low 80s to the high 80s. And we concentrate on the low 80s in terms of relative humidity for our practices. But what we also do is we use what I call extreme airflow. So we have 18-inch fans that are about 20 inches away from the face of each piece of ribeye or New York strip that we're aging. And what that does is that it dehydrates very quickly the front surface of the animal. And it creates a crust almost exactly like beef jerky, actually. And it's a very thin and hard crust. Now, what that does is twofold. The first thing is it protects the meat on the other side of the crust. So if you develop that crust slowly, it thickens, and you end up having more waste when we go to cut off and throw it away to get to the good meat. So that's from a loss perspective, it's better. The other thing it does is by dehydrating it very quickly, there isn't a surface that the mold, there's so little water that there isn't an opportunity for the mold to really form. It needs moisture. It needs a hospitable surface. Just like how beef jerky does not mold, even at room temperature, by dehydrating the surface, you lower the water activity and other factors to make it a place where mold growth won't happen. So kind of those two variables together, lower humidity and high airflow, prevent the mold growth. This is not the style of dry aging that other people are doing. Some people are actually purposely trying to get more mold growth to get that more funky style, like aging a funky cheese. Now, in terms of healthful versus not, I would think that there's two factors there. One is the type of mold. There are great molds for you and there are bad molds for you, and great fungus and bad fungus. Now, knowing which ones you're cultivating would require sending them to a lab to analyze. You can inoculate. Like adding, just like you would if you're dry curing salumi or hams, you could introduce penicillin or other varieties, which would then, have positive molds that could grow on them, positive molds and bacteria. So that's one way to do it, to create, to cultivate a better mold that you actually want instead of just what's randomly around. But the other thing I would say is that no one ever really eats the moldy part. The first step when we get to it is that we cut it off. So I'm not sure how much of that mold, even if there were harmful molds there, that the individual is actually consuming.
You mean you guys cut it off there at the butcher shop, or when
exactly.
people purchase
it?
Exactly.
So when you dry age something, even if you're going for the funky flavor, very little of that mold, if any, really penetrates into the meat itself. It almost all forms on the surface, and that you would cut it off before you would cook that meat or serve that meat. So I would be curious how much of, even if there were harmful molds and bacteria or fungus on the outside, how much of it you would actually consume, even if there were a lot on the exterior surface.
How long do you guys dry age your meat? How long is it actually sitting in there in that high airflow, slightly lower humidity type of situation?
Minimum 2 weeks is our kind of standard everyday product that goes in our case. And with a well-raised piece of meat, we'll go up to 60 days, on a well-marbled piece of meat, I should say. If there aren't enough fat, it doesn't age very well. It's a lower shelf life. We also don't age the grass-fed beef as long because the higher percentage of unsaturated fats are more volatile, and you're more likely to pick up off flavors in the grass-fed. So we stick around 2 weeks for the grass-fed only. We don't go further. You would benefit from some additional tenderizing. And I know some people like to go more like 4 weeks and more with the grass-fed beef because they want the additional tenderization. But we find with the grass-fed beef, there's enough tenderization, and we don't want the fats to start souring or pick up off flavors at all.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's say that somebody wanted to try this at home. Like mm-hmm. When I have a deer and I want to cure my own meat at home. Have you ever run into people who kind of try to put together their own home meat curing type of setups, like with an old refrigerator or something like that? And
well, I want to clarify, are we talking about curing or dry aging?
What's the difference?
Okay, so when we talk about dry aging, it's about taking a fresh meat product that you will still cook. And we typically, dry aging is done with beef, sometimes lamb, almost never with pork. And it's about aging it in a temperature, humidity, air velocity controlled environment to create a different product but is still a fresh meat product. Now, we talk about dry curing. Typically, we're talking about a salumi or charcuterie product where we're taking a raw product and converting it to a ready-to-eat product through using thyme and salt, thyme like the, 1, 2, 3, 4 minutes, not thyme as in the herb, but through thyme and salt and other ingredients, creating a ready-to-eat product through curing it. Now, that also involves a temperature, humidity, air velocity control environment. Typically, dry curing would be done above refrigeration temperatures, whereas dry aging is always done under refrigeration.
Okay, gotcha. So which of those processes, the dry aging or the curing, is the process where the mold or the fungus kind of forms on the meat?
Well, both, actually. I would say with dry curing, you need to cultivate the positive one. And mold and fungus plays a very integral role in creating those products and their flavor and what people call terroir by having different molds and funguses. And again, even with those products, you would typically cut off those molds and funguses as well. They're always going to be on the outside. If you see when you go into an Italian specialty shop and you get a salami that's really white, like it's almost like a powder-coated white color on the outside, that is a specific mold that they have cultivated for the outside. And they're cultivating a positive mold because they want to ward off negative molds that they're not controlling for.
Okay.
They're introducing mold that they want.
Now, is another word for curing wet aging versus dry aging, or is wet aging something also different?
So wet aging is also something that we do for beef, and that would kind of be paired in terms of what we're talking about. Wet aging goes with dry aging, not with dry curing. The curing, kind of, we put that off to the side, like making salumi and prosciutto and charcuterie. Wet aging is a process where instead of putting that beef New York strip in a temperature, air velocity, and humidity control environment, we vacuum seal it in a plastic bag, typically in our country happens 24 hours after slaughter, and you keep it under refrigeration and under vacuum. And what happens is you get the enzymatic process that makes the meat more tender, which is necessary for beef, less so for pork and lamb. But the enzymatic process breaks down the meat into more tender, but you don't get any of the water loss or any additional flavor enhancements through natural bacteria or anything like that. So the wider industry likes wet aging. It's easier to transport because it's already broken down. You can put it in a box. They like it because there's less water loss. So that same piece of meat will be heavier at retail because you haven't had any evaporation. And they like it more because you don't have what we call trim loss, that exterior surface I talked about that you would cut off and throw in the garbage. There's nothing that you got, there's no equivalent that you throw away. Now, the problems with it are is that, yes, you get tenderization, but you get a wetter product. Mm-hmm. You get something that sits in its own blood or juices. What that's going to do is give it like what people call a serumy flavor often, like almost tastes bloody. And also when you go to cook it, what happens is there's a lot more moisture in the product. So it's less likely to get that nice sear on the outside and more likely to kind of gray or brown. Because you basically have to boil off the liquid before you can really get a nice crust on it.
Okay, gotcha.
And 95% of the meat in our country is wet aged. And even the dry aged meat that you get at the supermarket was often wet aged, vacuum sealed before it got to the butcher shop where then they dry aged. Very little amount of beef is actually never put in plastic in our country.
When you are getting charcuterie at like a charcuterie shop, is that mostly wet aged then? Is it dry aged? Is it cured? Like, is there a way to know?
I would say in terms of wet aged or not, it would all depend. There's no kind of way, because you go to a charcuterie shop, that doesn't mean anything truthfully about how the animal is raised at all. Now, typically, shops like mine who are making charcuterie and they're coming up in the country, most of us are also paired with the ethics of working with small farmers. That does not mean that they exclusively are that way. There have been companies that make salumi in our country for the last 40 years that are just using commodity regular old pork. People trying to make distinctive high-quality products are looking for better quality pork, typically. If you think about all the Applegate farm stuff that's out there, I mean, they're just using commodity pork typically. There's nothing special about the pork. There might be creating, a more specialty product out of it, but there's nothing special about the pork that goes into it.
I see. Okay. So in many cases, you'll read nowadays like about how people are curing meat in their basement, like folks with a basement or a cellar with the right temperature and a humidity range. Is that something that you think is doable? Like, is it okay? Is it safe if you've got a good temperature and humidity range to just use your basement or your cellar, or like one of these old refrigerators that you can turn into a curing chamber to do this yourself at home?
For sure. I mean, it's not something that you just decide one day to do. I'm on a lot of Facebook groups about this. It's a mix of professionals and home enthusiasts. If you do want to do it, it's something you should be passionate about and really take the time to educate yourself about the safety behind and read up and join a group on Facebook that you can email all questions you have. A lot of the amateur people are taking pictures and say, hey, what do you think about this mold that I've got on my Brazaola? And you got people who are out there who have been doing this for 30 years be like, I just throw that one away, or I wipe it off with vinegar and you should be fine. Definitely, you have to take it seriously and respect it. Just like if you want to become a mushroom forager, right? You got to actually invest the time in learning. And if you do, you can do it safely and enjoyably.
Right. And if not, you're going to be tripping out for days underneath that tamarack pine where you picked a mushroom off.
These are serious things. You can cultivate some really nasty bacteria and the fungus and mold when you dry cure. You're curing something for a long period of time outside of refrigerated safety zones. Mm-hmm. So bad things can happen if you don't practice correctly. Now, that being said, we've been curing meat for thousands of years. So before the advent of a lot of technology that we have, it can be done safely at small scale for sure. You should be scared in a way that makes you respect the process, but not so scared that if you really want to do it, you shouldn't move forward.
Okay, gotcha. Are there any books that you'd recommend if people want to out there listening in and want to learn how to like cure meats themselves?
Sure. I mean, my basic starter book I tell everyone is the Michael Ruhlman book, Charcuterie. And he also has one called Salumi. They're a great starter book for getting started. And it also will recommend further reading and other ones. And his book is kind of, it's technical enough that a lot of professional kitchens have it around. Like we have it as a reference, mm-hmm. but it takes that technical knowledge and brings it down to the home cook and home enthusiast. It's enough detail in there that you can do this safely. It stresses the safety behind it and the basic practices that you need to know. You know, it doesn't have so like some of the other more technical books, lots of graphs on humidity and things that you don't need yet until you get more advanced. Also in the beginning, it's very important, I think, not to make up your own recipes. Find an established recipe and follow it to a T. Because it might get across your mind that an individual ingredient might be a bad idea, but it could be. Maybe it will increase moisture in a weird way inside that you don't want, or increase the chance of listeria or alter the pH. So in the beginning, you know, it's not like a fresh sausage that you're like, you know something, I love oregano, I'm going to put tons of oregano in it. It's a dry cured product. You should, in the very beginning, until you're very comfortable and doing it for a long time, follow the recipes, you know, really stick to it.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, for people listening in, you mentioned the Omnivore's Dilemma, some of the books by Joel mm-hmm. Salatin. I know I mentioned Beyond Bacon and then this charcuterie book. What I'm going to do is put links to these books for anybody who wants to pick these up. The URL for the show notes for today's post is at bengreenfieldfitness.com/choose-your-meat. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/choose-your-meat. And I'll also put a link over to Jacob's Dixon's Farm Stand Meats for those of you who are in the New York area. Jacob, I've got another question for you. And this is going to be kind of like a rapid fire 60 seconds or less style question. But what would you say in about 60 seconds or less is the ultimate way to cook the tastiest steak?
My universal method for cooking any steak pretty much is to use a cast iron skillet. I take my skillet, I put it on high on the stove for about 6 to 8 minutes. You want it smoking hot, can't even touch the handle without burning yourself. Steak at room temperature, took it out an hour ahead. Lots of salt, a little bit of pepper, more salt than you think you need because you're going to leave it on the pan. Right before I put it in the pan, I put a little bit of grapeseed, canola, or vegetable oil. No butter or olive oil, they'll burn at really high temperatures. I sear 4 minutes on the side on a typically 1.25-inch thick steak. It's a little thinner, a few minutes less, a little thicker, maybe up to 5 minutes. And that'll get you to the rare side of medium rare on almost any steak. If it's a bigger steak, anything over 1.5 pounds, thicker, I would then take the whole pan and throw it in a 350-degree oven for a few minutes. Mm. If it's anywhere from 2 to 10 minutes, depending on the size of the steak. And then most important thing, after you're done with the cooking, put it on the cutting board and don't touch it for 8 to 15 minutes, depending on the size. The bigger the piece of meat, the longer it needs to rest. And then slice it and serve it.
Why do you let it rest like that?
When you're cooking meat, it's a high temperature, extreme heat that causes the muscle fibers to contract. And if you cut right away while the muscle fibers are still contracted, the pressure inside the cells pushes all of the liquid and juices out. And even a great tender steak is going to eat very dry. By letting the meat rest, whether it be a sausage, a burger, a steak, a chicken breast, you allow it to come down from temperature a little bit, the muscle fibers relax, and it will eat much juicier. You can really take the same steak, and it will eat completely differently if you cut it right away.
Cool. I like it. All right. Well, I took some furious notes during our conversation. So if you're listening in and you want to check out some of the things Jacob and I talked about, the books, his website, his steak recipe, etc., head over to bengreenfieldfitness.com/choose-your-meat. Jacob, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
All right, folks. So this is Ben Greenfield and Jacob Dixon from Dixon's Farm Stand Meats signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com. Have a healthy week.
Visit bengreenfieldfitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.